When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is episode 93 of Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate classic rock podcast, with a new episode released every single day. You get an extended interview like this one every Monday, and short 4 or 5 minute daily episodes Tuesday through Sunday on a show that I call This Day Rocks. Loads of content for classic rock fans. Today's interview is with a fantastic character and an incredible bass player with an insane CV. Guy Pratt is a bass virtuoso whose talent has graced the recordings and live performances of some of the most iconic artists in history. With a career spanning several decades, Guy has established himself as a sought-after session musician, collaborator, and a force to be reckoned with on stage. Now, throughout his illustrious journey, Guy Pratt has lent his undeniable bass skills to legendary bands and singers. He is perhaps best known for his work with Pink Floyd, joining the band in the 80s following the departure of Roger Waters. Guy played a vital role in Pink Floyd's A Momentary Lapse of Reason and The Division Bell and their monumental tours, captivating audiences with his dynamic bass playing and backing vocals too. But his contributions extend far beyond Pink Floyd and the individual members as well. He's worked with a myriad of celebrated artists, including Madonna, The Smiths, Rod Stewart, Brian Ferry, Tears for Fears, Michael Jackson, Echo and the Bunnymen, and many more. Plus, as a comedian and podcast host himself, he's a fantastic storyteller, which is what we love on Vintage Rock Pod. So you're going to hear some great stories about working with some of the biggest names in music. What it was like being brought into Pink Floyd to play bass after Roger Waters left. What it was like working with Pink Floyd and then later with each member of the band on their solo stuff too. His friendship with Johnny Marr after a short stint with the Smiths. The very, very unusual studio session with Michael Jackson and so much more. He's a fantastic guest, so I really hope you enjoy this chat with Guy Pratt. Well, Guy, it's an absolute pleasure chatting with you. And as a classic rock podcast, the best place to start is Madonna. As you do. I want to start with the beginning. I mean, I heard you tell a story once where you said one of the very first things she said to you, I think it was a phone call at like 4 a.m. or something, was, I hear you're funny, make me laugh. I mean, what was going on?
I hear you're funny, make me laugh.
Yeah, she did. That's true. That's absolutely true. Because I'd, it was at the end of that first insane 13-month Pink Floyd campaign, really wasn't at all. And it was right at the end of it, Pat Leonard had come to a show, who was my friend from before Pink Floyd, who I'd met through Brian Ferry, who was, of course, Madonna's writer and producer. And he just said, what are you doing after this? And I was like, I had no conception of any sort of life or anything after. I assumed I was just going to die. Also, I mean, I really was so completely, bubbled, so to speak. And I'm not in a great way, to be honest. But I said, well, I don't know why. He said, well, how do you fancy playing on the next Madonna record? I was like, oh my God, that sounds amazing. So I was like, yeah, absolutely. Because bear in mind, she'd never used bass players before then. Even on the Nile Rodgers one, I think Bernard might have played on one song, but it's all synth. So she'd never had a bass player. True Blue was all keyboard. I probably should have researched that before I said that. So the tour ended. I went home, blah, blah, blah. Then we started arranging it. And then he said to me, who do you want to play drums? I'm like, oh my God, I get to pick my own drummer. So I picked this mate of mine who has a habit of doing this, it turns out. Though not for the last 30 years, he's been in a very regular gig. And she'd agreed all that. And so I had this section, we were going to go out. And then he blew it out a week before we were going out. And apparently Madonna just lost her mind. She was like, well, why are we getting this fucking guy? He can't even get a drummer to stay with him, you know. And so I was out. And there was, you know, I remember Pat calling me to tell me. And I was like, mate, please, you can't. He goes, I know how important it is with, the, you know, the nursery, the telling, the profile, the level of this album. I went, no, never mind all that. I've told everyone.
I'm going to be on with Madonna.
Yeah, exactly. So, but then, and... bless him, just credit. Apparently, the person I have to thank, really, forget me, that is Nick Kamen, who I knew. I've done some TVs with, and I knew obviously his brother Chester was one of my best friends in the world, who I'd been playing with. You know, he's an amazing guitar player. Toured with me with David Gilmour, in fact, years later, and we worked with Brian Ferry. But Nick was out in LA, and she was currently walking down Malibu Beach in a foul mood, and just bumped into Nick in the morning, and he went, yeah. Do you know who this guy Pratt is? And went, oh, Guy, yeah, he's lovely. Yeah, no, Guy's great. So that was it. So I was back in the picture. But frankly, the next thing I got was this phone call. And it was the first words she ever spoke to me.
Wow.
So, yeah, funny. Make me laugh.
I love the idea that this is the funny thing. Think about it, that Pat's last ditch attempt at getting me on the album is, but he's really funny.
And can you remember what you actually said to her? What did you
no
do anything?
No idea what I said. No idea what I said.
Ouch.
It goes back to, you know, when I was at school, backed up against the wall by a bully, you come up with something. Yep. So...
whatever it was, it obviously worked. It obviously worked. and as you said, working with Madonna, it wasn't just any Madonna album and any Madonna material. I mean, Like a Prayer, it was one of the biggest songs of the 80s. It was a defining song as well. It was a barrier-pushing song in terms of the video and things like that as well. And you played on that. And it wasn't as if you were just a background bass player. I mean, the bass lines on that song really shine through, don't they?
I know, it's amazing, and I still can't believe. In fact, yeah, I would say that was like her. That was the album where she sort of grew up and became a serious artist. It's, you know, the divorce album, as it's known. That's when she kind of did the George Michael, kind of really, you know what I mean, went to the next stage, and it was amazing, you know. And it also, because it had all these amazing musicians on it, and the songs were incredible, like fantastic, complex songs, a lot of them. And yeah, Like a Prayer, like I said, I still have a very vague memories of it, but it was the very fact I'm pretty sure that whatever I did when I did what I did that I was just mucking about. I'm sure it was one of those, okay, we've got it now, let's do one, just go nuts, you know. And I clearly did, and somehow it stayed on the album.
Incredible. So, what was she like to work with then in the studio? I mean, was she hands-on? Was she very proactive when
very hands-on. Amazing. Yeah. Incredibly impressive. Very, very professional. Incredible ears. Like I used to say when we did, because it was cut live, everything apart from Like a Prayer, everything was just cut live with the band.
Wow.
It was, I mean, the band, this is what amazing. It's like, why were they asking me for a drummer? We had Sugarfoot Moffat. I mean, come on. And the band was amazing. The band was, Bruce Gaich on guitar, Jay Winding on keyboards, yeah, and Pat on keyboards. And she would, like when we did Oh Father, we were just given the chart. We all sat down, we played through it. She sang it in the control room. And even though she'd been singing it, she then went around the whole band and gave everyone notes, and like really good notes.
Wow.
Like, you know, I remember her saying to me, "Guy, just duck eggs, except that one fill at the end. I like that. Keep that." And so, and you know, all her, you know, "Jay, no bells till the second chorus." Like really, you know, like a producer.
Wow. That's quite incredible.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, no, she's, you know, she's Madonna for a reason.
Absolutely. And one of the biggest stars in the world, and for a reason as well. But another huge star in the world, I mean, he obviously heard this song and he asked you to come and play on his music as well, Michael Jackson. I mean, how did all that kind of work in your head?
It really was an insane period in my life. I just wish I'd been a bit more present, because I've been on this roller coaster for a couple of years. Frankly, I was off my head half the time. And I was in LA and I was doing this, I'd become this sort of top session dog, which was never what I wanted to do. I had no, you know, obviously I wasn't going to say no, but it was just felt like a weird play. I mean, I had unbelievable imposter syndrome because, you know, I'm a bandy type, but I can't read music. I don't go to fucking Berkeley or, you know, and I was literally just forever stuck in rooms with people who played on Steely Dan records. And it was just like, what are you doing it? You know, I mean, kind of the only thing I had going for me was I was definitely the best dressed person. So this got to the point where I went and did the Madonna record, came home, then went back to LA and did the Toy Matinee project, which is still one of the things I'm most proud of in my life, which was produced by Bill Bottrell, who'd engineered the Madonna album, okay, who's just the insane, amazing maverick, and was behind Sheryl Crow and all sorts of, I mean, and worked with Jeff Lynne a lot, and then Michael Jackson, in fact. So, I went back and did this Toy Matinee project with him, which was Pat Leonard's sort of baby. And then I had to leave that before it finished to go back on tour with Pink Floyd, where we went to Russia and we played Venice. And then from that, I had to come straight back to LA to start Robbie Robertson's album.
Oh, wow.
And it was nuts. It was nuts. I'm like a few weeks into Robbie's record, and I get a call one day from Bill Bottrell, and he goes, "Hey, Guy, do you want to come and play on a Michael Jackson session?" It's like, what? He goes, "Yeah, you need to be here by 6. I was like, "Well, we don't really finish till about 7. So I said, "Well, I'll ask Robbie." And it was just as fun having to go to Robbie Robertson and go, "Robbie, listen, mate, is there any chance I could get off early tonight? Because I've got a Michael Jackson session." And he just went, "What am I supposed to say to that?"
Exactly.
So, and again, those sessions were just me and Bill in the studio.
Okay.
And his MD, but who wasn't someone whose name I can't remember, because it wasn't Greg Fillinganes, who's my mate, and it wasn't another guy. So and it was just weird because it would be just us, and there was this track, and apparently Michael had heard Like a Prayer. And so I was just, you know, they said he wants that vibe. So I'd assumed, right. So I had my Red Spectre, had my octave pedal, and I thought I was ready, God, this is gonna be Michael Jackson, it's gonna be some stomping groove. Fucking Don't Stop Till You Get Enough Part 2, and I'm gonna be all over it like a cheap suit. And and I got in there, and of course it's this, "What about sunlight? What about trees?" It's like, what? And so I came up with that line. Which is quite funny, in the fullness of time, which is, you know, which is the complete opposite. I mean, it couldn't be simpler. I mean, it's basically a slowed down Smoke on the Water. And but Michael wasn't there. And And I was asked to come back and, you know, come. And so I came back the next day. They said Michael would be there, went back. Michael wasn't there. And then, so I put down some more things. And then this happened about three times. You know, I kept coming back. They said Michael would be there. And then Michael never was there. And eventually I went, look, Michael would just be here. Tell me what he wants. I'll do it. We can all go home. And so I get a call next day from Bill. Guy, Michael's in the studio. He's not leaving. Right. Rush down the studio. And Michael's just left. But it was very weird. It was very different in the studio. There was this sort of massive Samoan bloke. Someone would be, I don't know, like better suited at being, well, I don't know, a bodyguard, perhaps. And he was down one end of the desk and he wouldn't let me get down there. Because this was back when you could smoke in studios. I think I was trying to get an ashtray. It kept blocking my way. It's like, all right. So I did a pass at it. And then this guy sort of leans over to the side of the desk and is sort of nodding. And he comes back and goes, yeah, I think Michael would find that appropriate. I'm like, what? That's weird. It's like this guy who can hardly speak English, but he's obviously somehow understands exactly what Michael would require from a bass performance. So, and then it becomes very apparent, of course, this guy is talking to someone who's hiding behind the mixing desk. And it's Michael Jackson. He's hiding behind the mixing desk. Yeah. So to this day, I never met him.
Wow.
He was in the room.
Very, very bizarre.
But there was a lot of that. Michael was going through a period of hiding from people at that time. I mean, there's a rather unkind rumor that I heard that someone said, who had been working on the session, said, well, things because he was having so much work done at the time. Interesting little sidebar here. There were, Spy magazine, which was an American sort of very sophisticated humor magazine in the 80s. They did a thing where they got an FBI facial reconstruction expert, because the FBI have these guys because loads of criminals, and they have their faces rebuilt as if you're on the run. So that, yeah, they just completely transform their appearance. So they don't have to hide all the time. And these guys can sort of see who someone is. And so they just showed him Michael Jackson from the beginning with all the work he was doing. And they said, so where's this guy going with this? And they went, Ramesses the second. And apparently he just had some really extensive work done. And he had a flap of skin hanging off.
God.
Yeah, hanging down under his eye. And apparently when he danced, which he liked to do in the studio, people would just throw up.
No.
That hasn't been verified.
Yeah, allegedly.
Allegedly, yeah. Some people say, yeah.
Yes, I say that's it. Oh, wonderful stuff. Again, on Vintage Rock Pod, we like to hear the stories behind certain bands and people that you've crossed paths with. And something very fairly early on was the Smiths. I mean, before they were supposed to go to the States, Andy Rourke, who we sadly lost very recently as well.
Yeah, very sad that.
Yeah,
sad.
Indeed. He was arrested for drugs and they didn't think he was going to be able to get there with all the rules and everything about getting into America and stuff like that. And you were hired, weren't you? You were called up to almost take his place for this tour, but it never actually went ahead. You never actually went over there, did you?
No, it went ahead. And kind of in the fullness of time, I've got a feeling, I don't think I ever really, I mean, I was an absolute last resort failsafe, but I don't think it was ever really, really on the cards. I think this was more about keeping Johnny happy, because Johnny Marr and I were in the middle of this kind of mad bromance, having the time of our lives together, running around towns, playing on loads of records. It was just the best. And there was a thing of, and I think that's what it was. I don't think Morrissey ever entertained the idea of me doing it or anyone else ever doing it. And I'm really glad I didn't. Because I would have just stuck out like a sore thumb. I don't think that was Andy's gig. And Andy, I mean, it was just a wonderful, wonderful week. I drive past the place every time because I live down in Sussex now.
Okay.
And it was a place called Stanbridge Farm, which is near Gatwick.
Yep.
And it was this beautiful old, I mean, it might be Elizabethan or something, beautiful old Tudor farmhouse. And it just had this barn attached to it, which was the rehearsal room. And it was a big thing, you know, people go and rehearse there for weeks. And then unfortunately, I think it might have closed because the road got widened a few years back, which is a shame. So which meant that the farm was right next to the road. So I don't know what it's become now, but I drive past it once, you know, a couple of times a week. So it's always there fondly in my memory, because they were just lovely. There was, you know, and it was interesting because This at the time, because they were huge at the time. Yeah. Huge, you know, what was funny was that, of course, they still had that air where you thought of them in terms of an indie band, but they were enormous pop stars. I mean, and of course, there were Red Tops, there were paparazzi hiding in the grounds and stuff, trying to, because they had this drug bust called, and like Boy George had just been busted for, there'd been a big thing with him. Yeah. And so he was sending messages of support. It's like, oh my God, we're in that world. And it was Andy showing me his parts and Smith's songs, and Andy's parts are really a lot more complicated than you think. The way Johnny writes is fantastic. Like, yeah, right, okay, there's this intro, which never happens again. And then there's thing that's like the chorus, but it's not. It's more of like a second intro. And then you got the verse, right? But it only happens on the first verse this time. And then there's like the bridge. But again, but this is the bridge. It's the same as the third bridge, but they're not the second bridge. And then you get to the chorus. But obviously, this chorus is slightly different to the other choruses. Then there's a second verse, which isn't quite the first verse. And they're amazingly crafted pieces. And, you know, and Andy's lines were pretty, he had a lovely melodic thing. So, and we had a week doing that. And of course, I'm a sober man now. So this is quite shameful. But on the last night, we just got completely off our nuts. And we had a game of football. I think we were all on acid and all sorts. When Johnny, when I was writing my book, I sent this story to Johnny just to say, mate, are you okay with me putting this in? And he went, yeah, Guy, it's fine. There's just one thing you got wrong. We did have the football match, and I think you were both referee and manager.
But anyway,
the story is, it was about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I went to bed, and I was lying there, and I thought, I haven't finished. So I went and started banging on John, what I thought was Johnny's door. Johnny, you can't wake up. Oops, sorry, that was probably too much. Johnny, wake up, bastard. Johnny, God, they. And then, of course, it was Morrissey's room.
Oh, no.
And Morrissey would have gone to bed straight after Dan's army. So he just got up, went and got the train, went back to London. And that was it. And then I went back to London and then just didn't hear anything.
Game over.
Yeah.
You mentioned your bromance there with Johnny Marr. I mean, obviously, he's such an influential guitarist, his style very unique, and all that sort of stuff. I mean, what was he like to play with on various things, and what was he like as a person to be around at that time? Because it was really, really exciting time.
A really exciting time. It was only because with Brian Ferry, Brian had this great idea of, there's Money Changes Everything, which is the B-side to Big Mouth Strikes Again, and is an instrumental. And Brian or someone else had the idea of Brian writing a song over that and putting it out, which is genius, because then that's Brian's way of tapping into those lonely tear-stained bedsits. And we did it, and for some reason, and we were just having trouble getting the track. And it was Brian who said, why don't we get the guy I play, why don't we get Johnny Marr in? And I was all like, I didn't really rate them, you know, I didn't, because it's that thing with this. It's the same, this has happened to loads of people I've introduced them over the years, where on the surface, you know, a lot of people just hear Morrissey. Hear Morrissey and you like it, you don't like it, you know, whatever. And it's an awful lot of people are like, well, I love what he's saying. I can't really, you know, not really love it. And you don't really, and you have to get past that, get past whatever your opinion is of that, even if it's good, before you really kind of pay attention, you know. And so Johnny turned up at the studio to play this song, and it was like, I was probably being all, yeah, whatevs. And, you know, we're all very, very young. I mean, I'm only 23 at this point, 20, you know. And so it's like, you know, arseholes, basically. And I know this thing I'll never forget, of he just plugged his guitar in. Okay. And he started, and I was probably reading a paper. And the second he started, I remember I was on my feet. So it was Chester, just ran over there to go, where's the other guy? Where is the other guy? Do you know what I mean? Because it was just two people playing a guitar. And it was just, you know, amazing. Because I say because Johnny is very much, he's like the other side of the same coin of David Gilmour, in that they both have that same thing of, they're an orchestra.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
In fact, that is still one of my proudest ever achievements is there's a song on the album Kite by Kirsty MacColl. It's thanks to me. The guitar credit is David Gilmour and Johnny Marr.
Wow. There you go.
Yeah. So, and again, he introduced me to Kirsty MacColl. So I played, in fact, first thing I played for her was brilliant. Was You Just Haven't Earned It Yet, Babies. I was playing a Smith song with Johnny for Kirsty. Fantastic. And then my relationship with Kirsty was brilliant. Went on for, and then Days, we did Days, her big hit, yep. Kink song.
Electric and, Landlady and everything. Yep. Yep.
Electric Landlady, all that. Yep. And, but do you know, it's such a great title, that.
Yeah, it is brilliant.
Her alternative title choice was going to was Al Green Was My Valet.
She had such brilliant titles, didn't she, with the Elvis and the Chip Shop and everything else. And
the wit on that one. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, we're still, I mean, I still, what's nice is that, you know, my son is now at Manchester Uni he's always the first person I call when I go up. And, you know, as often as not, you know, I'll go and see him. We'll come see him. He came out to have dinner in a Chinese with me and my boy last time I was up. It's adorable. Wow. He's just the nicest man in the world. And he's got that thing. There's only two people I know who are quite like this. I know lots of people still love it, but, and I'm not in, this isn't meant to be a diss of any other guitar player, but it just seems particular to both Johnny Marr and Phil Manzanera. Okay. Both seem to have this thing that every day, every time they pick up a guitar, it's Christmas morning, they're 10 years old, and they've just been given their first guitar. You know, it's that exciting to them. You know, it's so, and I envy that so much.
Fantastic stuff. Lovely stuff. And let's move on to Pink Floyd then. I mean, obviously your connection with them and every pretty much member of the group, you've played with them all solo and everything else. I mean, you're so involved. I mean,
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month. So just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the US.
You obviously, you didn't replace Roger Waters. That's the wrong way of putting it. But you came in afterwards. You can't replace somebody like that. That's not what would happen. No. But did you work with Roger solo stuff before or after the Pink Floyd stuff?
Roger?
Yeah.
I've done the thing. Because Pat Leonard produced Roger's next album after I'd done the Floyd, he produced, and which is funny because he co-wrote a song on Momentary Lapse of Reason,
yep.
The Floyd record.
Yep.
And then he was asked to produce Amused to Death, which he did. And I was actually asked to play on that by by Pat. And it was quite funny. And again, it's this thing of being young. I thought, whoa, that'd be hilarious. What a great gag that would be. And I thought, well, obviously, I need to ask David. And so I asked David and said, David, actually, I've been asked to play on Roger's album. Would you be all right with that? He goes, yeah, of course, it's fine. And I just thought about it for a second. I thought, it isn't, is it? It really isn't. It's not. So I didn't. So I turned it down, unlike some people. But I have worked with him I played with him and David at a Palestinian benefit. So, which was, and the funny thing, the idea was, I think one of them just said, I'll do it. But the deal is, we have to play To Know Him Is To Love Him, right? Which is a lovely gag and sounds great on paper. And apparently it's not just that it's not being obtuse. It's Pink Floyd used to do that as a sound check number.
Okay.
Back in the day, which I would love to. I'd love to hear a recording of Pink Floyd playing To Know Him Is To Love Him. But then, and it was all very funny. It was just going to be again, they were going to get up and do it. But then it all got, well, Roger wanted to change the key. and then this part, and then I can't sing this part, and then someone needs to do this part, and it's suddenly like, well, it's just, if we can't just get up and do it, it's not funny. Well, we're gonna have to fucking labor over this thing. It's not really a great gag anymore, is it? So I can't remember if we did it or not, actually. But it was great to do that. And then, of course, Roger came and sang with the Source of the Secrets.
Yeah.
But in New York. But those were simpler times.
Oh, there you go. So is that, yeah. Is that how you got into Pink Floyd then, that connection with your friend again, like saying, come on?
I'd first been brought to David's attention because I was playing for Dream Academy, Nick Laird Clothes Band, and I'd played on some demos, which I think David then went on and produced, and it's because Nick Laird Clothes, who he now does all the music for Nick Broomfield's movies, and he's still the most irrepressible, enthusiastic, oh God, yes, wow, sort of character. And brilliant, something I envy. and he'd obviously, you know, he played what I'd done on his tracks to David, and David had probably gone, that's all right. And of course, Nick's gone, David thinks you're amazing. He thinks you're incredible. So sure he doesn't. And we supported David on his solo tour at this in Birmingham. And so I met David. And again, you know, Nick's going, David's dying to meet you. He really isn't. And so I sort of presented, I was stuck with David backstage. And it was just, because, you know, David's not the chattiest guy in the world. Fantastic on email, though, must be said. Okay. That's his great medium. And we had this excruciating, awful meeting where just no one said anything, and him being the ranking officer got to walk away. And then I just started bumping into him places. I was obviously getting invited to better parties because I just started seeing him out. Also, because unlike other sort of mega rock stars, you only ever saw at gigs or at really swanky things parties, in Chelsea or in Mayfair. Right, that's where they lived. Yep. Okay, all that lot. David and Rick Wright were West 11. They were Ladbroke Grove boys, which is not Notting Hill. Notting Hill, not like it is now, but then Notting Hill was the coolest place in London, and it was everywhere up and down. And it was, but you wouldn't find any Claptons or Jaggers up there. So I think that's the thing that suddenly made me think, oh, these guys feel like home, because you know. And so I used to, you know, David used to go to 192, the wine bar we all went to. And so then it was basically, he was coming in to play with Brian Ferry when I was working with Brian. So I kind of got to know him. I was absolutely terrified of him. And I think that's how it came. And then I went on holiday to Thailand, my girlfriend too. And it was one of those ironic things where back in the days where you'd buy bootleg cassettes, right, of things. And I bought a copy of The Wall, which actually only had half the album on it. And I went on this total sort of Gilmore tip when I was on holiday. And I got back, and of course, this is back in the days of answer phones.
Yeah.
And when I think about it, I had one of those remote things where you could get it to play your answers down the phone, but I don't think they worked internationally or something, you know, the 80s, mate. And I got back and there's all these messages from David saying, I'm doing this Amnesty International gig with Kate Bush. You know, do you want to come and play with me? And then like, hi guy, I really want you for this gig. I'm going to come play with you. No. Hi guy, the gig's tomorrow. And then, okay, sorry guy.
Oh no.
And I got there and just like, oh no, that was my one chance. You know, and I blew it. So, but then like really not long after that, I saw it in Q magazine, which was brand new. It had just come out, Q magazine. And there was this thing about them doing an album. I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then I got a call from David out of the blue. And he was in LA. And it was, and this actually set the scene for my relationship with David for the next 40 years. And we just said, hello, guys. So I don't know if you've seen, but, you know, we're putting Pink Floyd back together and going on the road. So I've got two questions, really. One, would you be interested? And would you be available? It's 13 months.
Crazy.
So I'm odd. I think I could muster some interest, David. Yes, absolutely. And yeah, yeah, I'm available. And he went, oh, not working then.
Ouch. fantastic. And as you said, it was a grueling 13 months by the sound of things.
Yeah, well, it was done like a school year. That's what's sweet about it. Look about in the it was we went over, although it was August, we went over to rehearse in Toronto. And so yeah, we basically did the Christmas term in America when we came back. And we had 4 weeks at Christmas, just like at school. Yep. And then we had the spring term where we went to Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and probably a bit more America. And then it was the Easter holidays. Came home again. And then it was Europe.
Did someone have problem with childcare or something? Did they need to get home to look after the kids? Was that the issue?
I think that was probably like that. Yeah. I don't know. I think it was what these are the days. It was structured around a tax year, I believe. This is back when everyone used to do tax years out. Mm. In fact, because what's funny was, I mean, which I would never do. But what was funny was when I got the gig, top rate tax was 60%. So I was just like, fuck it, I'm not going to make any money anyway. I'm just going to buy some new suits and get smashed and it'll be great. But then literally just after I got the gig, they cut the top rate tax rate to 40%. It's like, oh, well, that's nice.
So when you join in a band like Pink Floyd, I mean, they're iconic, they're legendary. I mean, distinct sound. They've got a rich history, an iconic bass player as well in the past with Roger. So how did you approach kind of stepping into the role as the band's kind of bassist at this point then?
I got it all wrong.
Okay.
I got it all wrong in that I was playing all the wrong basses. I was too in my own... You know, it was the 80s. The 80s were about bass players. I was one of those kids. And it was all, you know, playing bass was not about, was all about putting your stamp on stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and much as I tried, and it took me a long time to, which I think actually in a lot of cases kind of worked, but it was like, but there's stuff, like I said, you know, things like, although I've had to reappraise a lot of the stuff I hated, I've kind of reappraised with fullness of time, especially during lockdown when I did this series of YouTube videos, Lockdown Lips. And there was all this stuff that I hated and have been so embarrassed about for years, like the slap break in Brick in the Wall and my bass solo and Money. And it turns out that people are incredibly fond of them and attached to them. So that's actually really, really nice. This is why when they redid Momentary Lapse of Delicate Sound of Thunder, and my bass solo got taken out of Money. And any time up to a few years ago, I would have been like, oh, thank Christ for that. But now I'm like, no, what did you do that for? And I actually get why you do it, because it just makes the song so long. And, you know, people listen to it. They are bass players, and they can find versions of it online. So I'm not really bothered.
Fantastic.
But, you know, because you've got to be honest, a lot of people are just going to skip through it anyway. Non-bass players are just going to skip through it.
Absolutely. And then we have to mention The Division Bell, another huge album, number one all over the world. And I think Nick Mason had said in an interview that your playing influenced the mood of that record as well. So tell me about what you remember with the recording and the putting together of that record.
That's right. I don't think that's really the recording of it. I think what Nick's talking about there, and bless him, that's very, very kind of him to say, they decided to start the album in the way that Pink Floyd used to start albums when they were sort of still mates, rather than someone just presenting their work to the band, which was where they just go in the studio and just, you know, jam for weeks, and just whatever came out, they would then whittle down and whittle down. And so they decided to go and do that at Britannia Row with just the three of them and me, which was an amazing thing to be asked to go and join in on. And also, but as part of the sort of soap opera that my life as Pink Floyd is that I'd been going out with Gala, Rick's daughter, for a bit, and we'd just been away for our first holiday, right? We went to Mexico for one of the most magical holidays I've ever had, 3 weeks going around Mayan ruins, backpacking, you know, and so I'd literally just got home from that. And because I lived just around the corner for Rick, I was designated as his driver. So I was driving to and from the studio every day. And I mean, I loved it. I adored it. But it was, things were still quite fresh. And I certainly wasn't going out with Carla for job security. Believe me, that was not helpful. And poor old Rick was getting teased terribly by David and Nick. Bands are just, they're kids, they're like school kids when they get together. So there was that element of it. But what was, I actually, in that time, kind of got very close to Rick because he was the one who just wanted to be in the room working all the time. And I'd never seen this stuff. They had all this old gear out. I'd never seen Rick's Farfisa or his Benson Echo or his, I'd only seen his kind of super 80s Kurzweil Zhuzhi stuff,
Yeah.
And it was great. So to see him, with his old organs and everything was brilliant. And so we just used to sit and jam a lot. So, I think quite a lot of grooves came out of that. Mm-hmm. And come about, I mean, because my natural inclination is to play, and especially then, it all gets better as you get older, is not necessarily too much, but more than Pink Floyd would like, often I come up with a line and David go, that's nice, but get rid of that. And then, you know what? He was, he's right. I mean, it's Pink Floyd. They know how it works.
You'd hope so. Yeah. And you mentioned, you mentioned Rick there. I mean, not many people talk about him. He was the quiet man, wasn't he? So what was he like?
He was brilliant. He was also, he was incapable of bullshit. Okay. Just incapable of it. He could only ever speak his truth, which could be very funny and very awkward sometimes.
I bet.
And he just wanted to be on his boat. And that's where I used to, he'd spent 20 years being bullied by someone. So, he was, that was the lovely thing about that album, was seeing this guy come back to life, hence the song, which I had a hand in writing, which was nice. He was always, that's why I sailed the Atlantic with him.
Oh, wow.
He used to do that every year.
Fantastic.
To sail the Atlantic Ocean. Yeah. And I always love that. Anyone who sails, I love, because, cars are obvious and easy, but sailing is elemental and it's how the world was found. And it's, there's something spiritual about it. So, always trust people who sail. And I live my life by that.
There's a t-shirt in there somewhere.
Yeah, there is. And that's why I used to love being with him on his boat. Because that's where he was happy and he was confident and in control and everything, he was a love. I mean, I used to love just him. I mean, one of my sort of most touchy memories, and of course, if it was in the days of iPhones, I would have just bloody recorded it, but I didn't, was when Stanley, our son, was born. We went down to France, his lovely house in France, and he had this piano. There was a piano in the House of France. There was something about it where I remember whenever we went there, I would walk in the door, I'd sit at that piano, and you'd come up with an idea.
Oh, magic.
It would make you have an idea. Yeah, there was something about it. And I just remember one time when Stanley was literally, he's just a couple of months old, and Rick sat him on his lap, and Stan's just going, bang, ding, 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 just whacking at the piano in that way that babies do. And Rick just was coming up with chords underneath him, sort of weaving around the sort of, Rick Wright chords around it. And it was just sublime. And and I was thinking, Stan, if you had any idea what was happening right now.
Oh, incredible memories, wonderful stuff. And then just someone else to touch on, Nick Mason. Obviously, you've worked with him for many, many years, but the Saucerful of Secrets stuff, which has been going on for the last, maybe 6 or 7 years now, is it something like that? But
No, it's 5 years. It's five, it 5 years. Yeah. Well, not, I mean, annoyingly, we had, we had a 2-year break.
Yeah, of course.
We were, lockdown happened the week before we were starting rehearsals for our next tour. So, that's amazing. So, we kind of made up for it last year. last year, because I've never toured like this before. Nick certainly hasn't. Like I said, this is the first time he's ever slept on a tour bus. and he loves it because it's the sort of touring that now, as I get, I used to love, you know, the thing of just hanging around, being in a city for 3 days and just doing, whereas now, can we just get on with it, you know? So we move so fast. Like in Europe, we did 60 shows in 90 days in 29 countries.
Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible. A lot of traveling. And then you went across to America, didn't you, as well last year? And then you did a lot of stuff with Pantheon.
5 weeks in America.
Yeah, Pantheon Podcasts, who Vintage Rock Pod are a proud part of as well. And you met a lot of people across there. And I know you did a lot of interviews with the different podcasts which are involved. And that American tour went down an absolute treat. Everyone was saying what a fantastic show it was. And it just went so well for you guys.
Yeah, no, it went brilliantly. Although because it was the third time that tour had been rebooked. So some of the venues were weird. We seemed to end up in a lot of musical theatres. Okay. You know, places that would sort of have Frozen on the rest of the time rather than, and it's kind of, for us, it was actually the more rock and roll theaters tended to work better. But yeah, no, it was a great tour. And of course, Gary and I still managed to keep our podcast going all the way through all of that. So, which is great, but it's like slightly when you're having, you know, because we research a lot. So,
Yeah, it's not easy. And just quickly on the Source of All the Secrets, I heard you say in another interview that it's the most fun and fresh thing you've ever done because you're getting to play the music that Pink Floyd probably didn't even play back then when they recorded it or haven't done so for 40, 50 years. So it was so nice to go back to that psychedelic stuff and play the stuff that had just been sat for so long on vinyl, basically.
That's the thing, exactly. Where the key thing is, it's not new, but it's fresh.
Yes, you know,
it feels really fresh. These songs feel fresh. I think that songs get tired from being played too much. You know, I'm sure comfortably numb's going, oh, can I just have a rest? but that's the thing. A lot of it hasn't been played, but also it's because what's lovely is it connects Nick to who he was, that kid that he was. And it connects everyone else to who they were. It connects me to my first band. It connects Gary to him as a kid, you know. So, and it has this lovely typical effect. But also, because it's kind of Pink Floyd as a pop group and it's playful and a lot of it's light. I mean, a lot of it's still quite dark and intense. But there's also all the different colours, you know. I mean, stuff like Obscured by Clouds, where we go into, you know, and when Nick's laying down this like full-on krautrock groove, and it's, you know, so it's great the places it goes.
Fantastic stuff. And then just to finish off, you mentioned before we started recording that kind of podcasting is your life at the moment, isn't it? And yourself and Gary rock on tours, and it's a fantastic show. It's brilliant. You interview some of the most incredible guests across the musical world and everything. So fill us in on all that that you're doing right now.
Well, we just did our first live event. In fact, our episode this week was our first live one because we have this running gag. There are things that keep, for some reason, no matter who we're talking, things that always come up are prog. There's always everyone has some sort of prog reference. And with it, people either, it was either the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show or the Sex Pistols at the Screen on the Green. That's the thing that kicked people off. And Gary was at the Sex Pistols at the Screen on the Green gig, right? And I'm never allowed to forget it. but then as part of the London Podcast Festival, we got offered the Screen on the Green to do a live event. And so we went and did our first live rock on tours with Steve Diggle from the Buzzcocks, who also played that night, and Glenn Matlock from the Sex Pistols.
Oh,
and it was just like the most brilliant kind of... And then, in fact, David Coverdale, who's become the sort of patron saint of the rock on tours, who we just adore, he actually recorded a special video intro for us.
Oh, wow.
As well. So, so that was nice. And hopefully there'll be more of those coming up, live things.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Guy, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you for the last, nearly hour. Thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful hearing all your stories.
You're very welcome. All the very best to you.
There you go, the brilliant Guy Pratt there. Check out the podcast he does with his good friend Gary Kemp. It's called Rock on Tours and it's available, everywhere, really. Well, that's it pretty much for me this week on The Big Interview Show. Thanks again for listening. Make sure you subscribe to Vintage Rock Pod on your podcast app so you get all the episodes that are released every single day. And please do leave Vintage Rock Pod a 5-star review on the podcast app that you use and look for Vintage Rock Pod on YouTube as well. You get to see all the videos of these classic rock stars that I've interviewed over the years. Anyway, I'm going to be back tomorrow with more On This Day Rock Goodness with This Day Rocks. So until then, take care.
Hold up. It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.